listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa, on this beautiful June day, 2015, if you're listening to us on our original broadcast. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone, or good morning, depending on when you're hearing us. But right now, today, it is a beautiful day. It was supposed to rain today, but obviously somebody misguessed. It's okay.
It's not, the day's not over.
Right, that's true. That's very true.
But I'm hoping it holds off for another hour while we're on the air here.
Yeah.
And then I get to ride my bike to my next location. And not get sopping wet.
Right.
So that's what I'm hoping for. And before we get into today's guest, I do want to mention that we've got the Ink Fingers Creative Prose right. Contest going on right now. This is your opportunity to get published by First World Publishing. You'd get a full the winner gets a full publishing contract, and it's an online and on-air contest. So if you can send 10 to 20 manuscript pages from a completed creative prose manuscript, which is fiction, nonfiction, memoir, a creative nonfiction or memoir, and you can email it to inkfingers with a Z at lisco.com, and there's full details about other ways to get it to us at writersvoices.com, so you can check it out there. And we will be having a public reading at FairFest on Sunday, 2 p.m. at Art 52 Art Gallery. That's right across from the courthouse, right near all the FairFest activity Sunday.
Yeah.
June 21st, and then the online voting will begin in July to choose the winner. So
okay.
All right. So who do we have with us today, Mom?
Today we have Javier Cavazos, right? Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Okay, and this is a very interesting book, and something I certainly did not know, that George Washington Carver graduated from Iowa State University. I thought that, I've heard this name forever. We're going to find out who he was. We're going to ask the author who he was. This is a book of poetry, and very unusual poetry. The author earned his BA from Central Washington University and an MFA in creative writing and the environment from Iowa State University. And he's been a member of three national poetry slam teams, and we're going to talk about that later.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He's the author of Barbarian at the Gate, which I'm sure many people are familiar with, and was selected and introduced by Thomas Sayers Ellis as part of the Poetry Society of America's New American Poets and Chapbook Series. Diamond Grove Slave Tree was selected as the inaugural Ice Cube Press Prairie Seed Poetry Prize. And he has taught writing and composition at Iowa State University, currently teaches in the writing specialization program at Central Washington University, as well as in the Africana and Black Studies. So, Javier Cavazos, is that right?
Yeah. Author of Diamond Grove Slave Tree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Welcome to Writers' Voices.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure and honor be here and to be speaking with you all about poetry and the love of writing and how to research writing and all the good stuff. So thank you very much. It's really exciting for me as well.
Now, where are you calling us from today?
I'm calling you from bright and sunny and hot Ellensburg, Washington. It's in the central part of the state. It's almost right where Ames or Des Moines would be centrally located in Iowa, where a small state school just kind of like there's a small state school in Iowa called Central, too, in Pella. We're in Ellensburg, Washington, right in the middle. It's very similar to Iowa as well. It's an agricultural state, and we're a rural kind of ag school, not nearly as big as Iowa State University, of course, but we do a lot of Timothy hay farming, and then corn. So we don't really have the bounty that we get there in Iowa with all the farmers, all the food farmers that are there. Unfortunately, even though there's a lot of farming here, most of it taken up with Timothy hay for kind of special horses that are primarily, most of the hay is shipped off to over to Japan.
Oh, wow.
There's horse breeders over there that want to really spoil their horses with this Timothy hay. It's a little bit more expensive.
That's interesting.
That's kind of what our little region is kind of famous for, is our Timothy hay.
Well, shipping hay across an ocean, the shipping costs must be more than the cost of the hay.
Yeah, no, and apparently I haven't ever visited any of the farms over there, but from what I hear from my friends here, that it's really kind of the elite, wealthy kind of ranchers over there that have these horses. And, the family that owns the hay, it's called Anderson Hay over here, and they're millionaires. They have their own little jet and everything to jet off to. So it's really lucrative. Whatever it is, it's almost, I guess, kind of like the high end for horses, their food, I guess.
Wow. Now, I always think of, when I think of agricultural production from Washington State, I think apples.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're just about 30 miles from some really good apple orchards. We're in a valley. And so on the other side of the Menashtash Ridge, which is the mountains that separate us from Yakima County, and that's where a lot of our apple orchards are. We have cherry orchards as well.
Mm-hmm.
Also, wine has been kind of big now along the Yakima River. But that's about 30 miles from here, and unfortunately, like I said, when you're in a valley, you really do kind of get cut off from, even though it's only 30 miles from here, it's really like a big wall. Mountains between us kind of serve as like a wall and don't really allow us to access that area as easily as we should. But yeah, totally. We got good Washington apples over there, and also potatoes. We have potatoes and other smaller crops. It's just here in Ellensburg. I remember in Ames when Joe and Lana's from their farm, one of their Onion Creek, I think it's called, or not Onion Creek, but they have there's some kind of organic farms there, and I remember seeing it every year. There'd be a big bounty of food out, people open out. Homeless and other kind of populations that need food there, and so we kind of miss that here.
Wow!
But other than that, we're similar students. A lot of the students that I have here at Central Washington University are really similar to the students that I had at Iowa State University, and ag related. In fact, in the fall, we brought Deborah Marquardt out here to read. She came out here and read from her book, The Horizontal World, and also from her new poetry book, Small Buried Things. And so it was really neat. It was kind of nice to have a former mentor and teacher come visit me here at this school and then read to our audience. Mm-hmm. And out of all of our readers that we had this year, and we had a pretty powerful lineup, I would definitely say Deb was the most well-received, and the students just really talked about her performance, and she sang songs and kind of talked about, what it's like to date, farm boys and stuff like that. A lot of things that the audience here at Central could kind of relate to. So it was really neat to be able to bring her out here.
Well, Javier, how long did you live in Iowa?
I was there for 4 years. So it was the MFA program I started in 2010, and it's a 3-year program. It's the way, of course there's Iowa, right? The University of Iowa Writers Workshop, which is like the holy grail of creative writing in America. And then when Iowa State University wanted to propose their MFA, the school board regents, I believe it's from U of O or University of Iowa, Iowa State University, and then Northern Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they all kind of put their brains together, and they said, well, we'll give you guys an MFA, but it has to be, radically different than what the University of Iowa's program is, because they already have the premier program. And so what they did is, I think Deb Marquardt and Steve Pett and some other people there that were, you know, running the program at the time, thought about, well, what could we do differently here? And there was already a really big environmental focus at, you know, in Ames and at ISU. So it's called an MFA in Creative Writing and the Environment.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's really neat for us students that aren't typically that passionate about, you know, quote unquote literature, you know, like Shakespearean literature or whatever. I mean, we're totally fans of literature, don't get me wrong. But rather than take like three extra classes in, you know, early American literature or Victorian, you know, literature or Shakespearean literature or whatever, we got to take like classes in agronomy and soil, you know, soil conservation or water, you know, sustainability. There's a sustainable ag program there that does a colloquium. And we got to take that class. And so we learn about all these environmental issues that are really pressing the world. And the hope, I think, was for the program and still is, and it's been very successful at this, is to get their students to come in, do science, you know, environmental science work in addition to their writing, and then write, you know, and then have their writing inform, or have those classes inform their writing. So in a way, they are like a, you know, environmental writers, environmental science writers, conservation writers, and then even beyond that, it would be more like, you know, just voices for nature, you know, maybe poets or fiction writers that want to personify the woods or a creek or you know, the rocks or what it means to be losing, you know, our water or losing this and that, so that nature has a informed voice, sort of. And it's been really successful. I think Melissa Sevenry, I can't pronounce her last name, but it used to be Lamberton, Melissa Lamberton, and she just got a book published on the arroyos in Arizona by the University of Iowa Press. So U of I Press, which is, you know, one of the greatest presses out there, is going to be publishing her book on water issues that are going on in Arizona right now. So it's really fantastic, and they're having a lot of successes with their students now, and the program is really taking off. And I would say, for what it is, you know, the type of program that focuses on the environment as well, it too is holding its own now as one of the top programs in America, just a little bit different. And then the neat thing that kind of I like is that since I was there in 2010, and even basically up until awards that are being won right now, so for the last 5 years, I would say, you know, these last recent 5 years, that the ISU students have been competing or actually out-competing, you know, outdoing U of I students in terms of publications and books and awards. I mean, we're really on a roll for these last 5 years, and I would say if we put up all of our awards and then listed all of U of I's student awards, that we're really, if we're not outdoing them, we're definitely the same. And so that's really neat, and that's a testament to the faculty there in Ames and just the great job that they're doing.
Well, the environment and environmental concerns are very, very important to all of us. And so that's
absolutely
great. That's really great that they did that.
Yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Javier Cavazos, the author of Diamond Grove Slave Tree, which is a book of poems telling the life story of George Washington Carver. So let's talk a little bit about Carver. Did you know anything about him before you came to Iowa State?
You know, when I was applying to MFA programs, I had a teacher, her name's Catherine Whitcomb, who actually taught there in Ames. She was a visiting writer for 1 year, I think in 2001. And I think Steve Pett or Deb was out on a sabbatical, so she was there. And then she was my undergrad teacher here as I was wrapping up my undergrad degree. in 2008 or 9. And so she had turned me on to Iowa State University. So after I sent my application, I went on. One of the first things I do is look at the university's library. Now, it's always a good, kind of a good index about what that school's going to be like, kind of based on what their library kind of has or what they're doing. So I was looking at library websites, and I came across the Parks Library website, and they had a, at the time, it's kind of hard, it's harder to find now, but at the time it was really prominently on their main page was their digital collection of George Washington Carver's archives. So I just kind of clicked on that and started going through it, and I was really fascinated by his narrative and the story about that. And so I was really enthralled with that, and I had received offers from the University of Miami, the University of Arizona, and then also, you know, ISU. So I was, you know, debating which school to go to, kind of which offer was the best, you know, kind of for myself and my family. And as I was debating that, I had a dream one day, because I, you know, been doing a lot of reading, and I dreamt that I was in this fantasy world that I'd never been in before. It was this place called the Casey property, and it was this mythical, magical, forested place. And I had never been there, but I had read about it on the MFA website. They were talking about that some person had donated, I don't know, up to, I think it's about 100 acres of natural prairie in its original state to Iowa State University's MFA program, and that we'd get a chance to go out and kind of do research, have a little bit of scientific research going on there with, you know, some of the plants or the animals that live there, and you could do research, and you map the Casey land, and there's a little creek that goes through there as well. And so I've been reading about that, and in my dream, I dreamt that I was on the Casey property, and I was there with George Washington Carver, and I was dreaming of him, and he was a young man, so it wasn't an old Carver, it was a younger Carver, and I was in my current state of age, and we were just, you know, running around, almost childlike dream, but I remember him in my dream asking me to come to Iowa State University, and it was such a, you know, again, it's just a dream, so, you know, you can read it however you want, but to me it was really mythical and spiritual and real in a lot of ways. And so that was, to me, when I woke up, I said to my wife, I said, I know where we're going. And, you know, it was, I didn't realize it at the time, but it was, you know, the best place definitely to go. You know, my heart was like, oh, I want to go to Miami, the University of Miami, and, you know, South Beach and all this stuff. But Miami is probably not the best place for, you know, a middle-aged person with a family and three little kids to go. And as it turned out, you know, Ames, just my family fell in love with Ames. You know, my kids mm-hmm. went to Meeker Elementary, and the teachers at Meeker are just amazing, and then, you know, it's such a small, you know, just a wholesome place that, you know, we weren't worried about crime, we weren't worried about, you know, theft or anything like that, and it was just it turned out to be a perfect place. And then also it gave me something to jump into. Right when I got on campus running, I knew I had a project I wanted to write about George Washington Carver. I didn't know exactly if it was going to be a paper or poetry or, you know, what, but I was just so enthralled with his narrative. You know, slave narratives have always, in general, interest me. It's kind of like, you know, so for example, you know, without getting too crazy on the radio, you know, like Bob was a victim of sexual abuse as a child. I had an older cousin who was about 5 or 6 years older than me, you know, who he was my favorite cousin as a child, you know, up until he started molesting me. And that happened for about 5 or 6 years, but it's a trauma. It's a deep trauma that happens to the person. And so it doesn't matter how far healed I've been. Because there's all kinds of stages of dealing with that. You know, one of the first stages is that you feel as a victim that it's your fault, and that you somehow, that like I did, you know, that I created this this abuse to happen for myself. And then, you know, at a certain point, dealing with this issue, I thought it would be good if I, like, in earnest, forgave my cousin. So I, like, reached out to him to try to let him know that, hey, no matter what you think about this, I want to let you know that I've forgiven you and that, you know, that I care for you as a human being beyond, you know, I don't necessarily want to be in the same room with him anymore, but that I still care for him as a human being, and I hope that he has a good life. And that, you know, I just felt that that would be part of the healing process as well. But boy, I tell you, it's been, you know, probably, you know, close to 40, well, not going on 40 years, but 35 years, you know, where I've lived with that now. And it's still, as much as I try to put it behind me or resolve it or come to some understanding about what, you know, what it was or why did it happen, that it's still in my mind, and it's still close to my mind, and it's close to my heart every day. I mean, here it is, we're on a radio show, and I'm talking about it, you know. So it's an issue that keeps coming back to me, and it's the same thing for the slave narrative in American history. For whatever reasons, you know, I mean, there's lots of atrocities I'm sure I could kind of grab onto as a Latina, you know, in America, and there's lots of issues with migration and, border issues and things like that I could be talking about. But the thing that keeps coming back to me, the same way I keep kind of going back to my own abuse as a child, is America's traumatic scar or traumatic abuse, which I believe is, you know, the slave trade that we created here in developing America, you know, and from 1611 Jamestown to even now, you know, I would call mass incarceration as just a modern slavery, or that there's other issues, you know, there's other things, like, you know, the NCAA and athletics could be another argument of still modern slavery in a lot of ways. But that, just that trauma, that, you know, the fact that we could essentially kidnap and steal people from one continent and bring them over here, force them to be in forced labor, rape and, you know, rape the women and all the stuff that happened with, you know, slavery, and that we're supposed to now just kind of move on, you know. And so for me, in everything that I do with my art, it's kind of that's one thing that I just keep coming back to, is, or that fascinates me, any writing on slavery or any photos of slavery or any history or documents or artifacts. I'm just so caught up in them emotionally, because it's a trauma. It's one of those traumas that, you know, I don't see how we can just forget so quickly, you know, how it is that it happened, you know. And that's a saving grace of Iowa. Iowa, for, you know, the state, you know, as you all know, because you're Iowans, is really a giant state made up of thousands of or hundreds of little towns, and some of them even under 500 people or less. But, and the state in general is very conservative and probably Republican, but that, you know, we are in Iowa, the people of Iowa historically have always, you know, and this is a generalization as well, have always been on the right side of history.
Right, and often very progressive.
Go ahead.
And often very progressive.
Very progressive. Very progressive in a place that you mainly wouldn't expect it. And so that's a beautiful thing. I think that, you know, that it was a free slave state. It was bordering with Missouri, which of course is a horrific state for slaves. And, Iowa was one of the first states, for gay marriage, I believe, as well. And we delivered Obama, you know, the first, you know, both times, the first time around. I mean, so really progressive and just, you know, very socially conscious, and so it just seemed right. It seemed like the right thing to do to write about Carver. I was really fascinated about how someone could be born in, you know, like we look at our lifespans, and, you know, we think about, I still remember, you know, being at my grandma's house with the little rotary phones, and, you know, now we're on phones. Mm-hmm. Where realistically, even though we're doing this interview over the telephone, we could be doing it, you know, via the little FaceTime as well, and we could be looking at each other.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing.
So, you know, we've had these big technological gains, and so I look at Carver's lifespan. I'm like, wow, he was born a slave. You know, he was born the year before slavery was abolished. So, I mean, as an infant, he was a slave. And then, you know, you still have all the laws and the injustices. You know, I mean, he was admitted into Highland Park University in Kansas, and then when he got there, they saw that he was, you know, African American. They didn't let him in. You know, it's even interesting with Iowa State University in the sense of that he was their first African American student in 1881, but African American students couldn't live on campus until I believe it was probably, the number's not going to be 100% correct, but it was around the 1940s.
Wow.
When that was changed. And there's actually a house in Ames, Iowa called, what's their last names? I can't remember. Their last names are leaving me now. But they were the house that housed all the African American students.
Mm.
Wait. Because they couldn't live on campus, and so, and the house is still there. I know Gloria Betcher, who's a faculty member at Iowa State, but also is in the city council there in Ames, I believe, and works with their Ames Historical Society. They're trying to get that house saved and put on the historical mm-hmm. record. It's where George Washington Carver lived. Or would stay when he would come back and visit. They actually kind of made a big exception for him, and Joseph Budd and Lewis Pamel had their offices in Cat Hall in Iowa State University, but now Cat Hall back then was called Old Biology, and they actually let Carver stay in the basement in there so he could live on campus without people really knowing. And it's just kind of an interesting little bits of history that you find there. And the Martins, that's their name. Archie, I think it was Archie Martin and Nancy Martin, maybe. But they're the Martins of Ames. And he worked for the railroad that used to be there, used to go through there. And now there's actually a residence hall at Iowa State University. It's called the Martin Hall. It's named after the Martins.
Wow.
That provided safe and clean housing for the black students that were there prior to them being able to live on campus.
You know, I've heard that name, and I know I'm sure I knew what his achievements were long ago when I was young.
George Washington Carver.
But
yeah.
I couldn't recall. So, and I'm sure many of our listeners are not sure either. So why don't you tell us something about what his achievements were?
Who's that? I'm sorry, the Martins or George Washington Carver?
Carver, yeah.
Okay, well, yeah, for sure. So Carver, you know, was born enslaved. He was stolen by slave raiders, actually, by Arkansas slave raiders as an infant. Slave raiders came on to Carver. So the Carvers were German Baptist slave plantation owners. And Mr. Carver had a plantation, and George Washington Carver was one of the slaves, essentially, and was stolen with his mother and some other slaves. They were stolen by slave raiders. So Carver's men went after them, and they found Carver. They actually bought him back. It was really unusual to buy property back or buy people back that were so young. But he gave a horse for George Washington Carver and got him back. Kept him in the house, you know. If people don't know, if you don't know much about George Washington Carver, one thing you should know about him is that he's kind of slight in stature. He's very fragile and feminine in his body language and mannerisms. He has a really high pitched voice, so I think if you were just to be around him or listen to him, you might think that he's maybe homosexual or just because of. You know, his mannerisms and stuff like that. That's something that's never been proven one way or the other. There's no research. Carver himself never spoke about it. I know he in some of his records, it talks about him having a girlfriend. But I think that was just more of a friend acquaintance. And so when I was doing research for the book, I was really trying to look for any smoking guns that would kind of lead me one way or the other. So the common myth that maybe people have heard about Carver is that he was castrated as a young boy by Moses Carver. And I don't think that's true. There's nothing in any of the diaries or correspondence or anything that would suggest anything like that. Although, it's just hearsay. You know, someone in some records say they saw that he was castrated. Some people say that that's not confirmed. But that's one of the reasons that some of the Carver scholars will say is why his high voice is. There kind of is a wall that's kind of put up right now in general that, you know, not a lot of Carver scholars believe that George Washington Carver was homosexual. They believe that, you know, his high voice was due to early castration. So, you know, in my book, I put it as imagined, but I do write in his voice, and I do write in his voice in a fond, romantic way towards a student of Carver's. His name was Austin Curtis. And Austin was Carver's assistant at Tuskegee University. So Carver went around. He was taken in by Moses Carver. Right away they realized that he had a real ability with farming. That they called him the plant doctor, even as a little kid. That he could, you know, a sick plant, he could get healthy again. And so they started seeing all the stuff that he could do with that, and they knew that he was special. So the schools that they had set up that were just little kind of makeshift schools for the African communities that were there, he basically got through his high school equivalency of a high school diploma by the age of 12 or 13, and he was ready to go off and start going to more school. But he just kind of wandered a little bit. And, you know, did odd jobs, would work on different little farms and try to make his way. And he painted a lot, so he was really talented in painting. And when he was in Highland Park, that was in Kansas, he was admitted into Highland Park, but, you know, wasn't admitted in there when they realized that he was a black student. And then he was at, and it was a school somewhere in Des Moines now. I don't think it's there anymore, but there was a woman, Etta Budd, who was Joseph Budd's either, this part now is getting a little blurry on me, it's been a while. I think it was his either his daughter or his wife. So, there's a big difference there. But somehow, one of the Budds, a female Budd, saw Carver's painting and said, "You need to study plant biology with my father or with my husband at at the time it wasn't called Iowa State University. It was a technical Iowa State college or something like that. But then so they met and they right away realized, oh, the Carver has a genius recollection of plant types. He could see a plant and name it and tell it all about, you know, he could tell you everything about it. So they admitted him into Ames, and he was an undergrad student there from 1881 to 1885, I believe he graduated, and then he got his master's, continued on there at Iowa State University with Joseph Budd and Lewis Pamel, and got his master's degree in 1887, and then they hired him here. He was their first black faculty at ISU. And that same year, Booker T. Washington called him, sent him a telegraph, and asking him to come join him in Tuskegee University in Alabama and see about forming an all-black college. And I think that really resonated with Carver, this idea about being able to go somewhere and essentially start from scratch, literally, as well. You know, when they were building those labs, some of those first Tuskegee labs, it was literally, you know, like kind of going to a guard cell and seeing what you could find that would make, you know, that would work. and Carver was such a genius, you know, they say necessity is the key to ingenuity or something like that. And that's been Carver's whole life, you know, that never having what he needed, but yet being able to produce product of superior substance, you know.
And he started,
so I took that aesthetic, and so he was at the CD, and then he went on to patent over 300 different uses for the peanut, the goober, and the yam, both the peanut and the yam, and had scientific, help scientific medicine, painting oils. You know, he used to have these massage oils that he would make that were healing oils. You know, he was really fond of putting his oils on the students at Tuskegee, you know. So that's kind of some of the other innuendos a little bit about his sexuality. He was always rubbing the backs of young boys. And Austin was his assistant, who he basically moved into his on-campus residency. And the smoking gun for me, in terms of his, you know, sexual orientation, was just that him and Austin were inseparable, you know, for probably going on more than a decade of his life. And that when the morning after Carver passed away, you know, he died in his sleep there in his residence hall on Tuskegee University. And, you know, he died that evening. The next morning, Booker T. had Austin Curtis and all of his belongings physically removed from campus. And so I just always wondered at that. What would cause the president of the university in those times to have, you know, your number one faculty's assistant physically removed off the premises if it wasn't for the fact that there was a sexual relationship going on? Or, and who knows if it was even ever sexual. Maybe it was just a thing, you know, because, you know, there was a lot of barriers, not just racial barriers, but barriers of sexuality as well that were very strong in those times as well. And so, you know, to me, that was enough for me to go that way. But of course, I've already received some emails from scholars saying that, you know, my work is blasphemy. People said, one person said it was blasphemy. One fan of Carver just kind of said that I was crazy and a nut, and but you know, I expect that in terms of the African American community of scholars, you know, homosexuality is kind of it's not really a topic that's discussed out in the open very much. There's a lot of misconceptions about it, and so I don't know, you know. Mm. I don't think that there's going to be anyone in 2015 that will be able to find evidence that would definitely go one way or the other. So I just thought that I would go with my spirit, what I felt my spirit was drawing me to, you know. And then, of course, Carver late in life received a bunch of awards. Thomas Edison had offered him a $100,000 a year contract to come work in his labs. He turned that down. Wow. He wanted to stay working in the South. He wanted to continue to working on issues of food, you know, making sure that poor black rural folks in the South had food and ways that they could, you know, grow their own food. He had a little wagon called the Jessup, the Jessup wagon that he would take around and basically do small little workshops with anyone that would come into the wagon and learn how to grow crops that would be that would be sufficient, you know. And of course, one of the things he was really famous for is that he called ahead of time. He knew what was going to happen with the boll weevil. He knew that the way that the South was harvesting cotton, that it was depleting the soil of its nitrogen, that they were going to need to vary, you know, to have variations of the crops, and he foreseen all of that and predicted all of that and was 100% right in that. And then, you know, died when he died. President Roosevelt or FDR, I think it was Roosevelt, you know, called him a national hero, national treasure. And of course, even today, we're still living off his inventions. We're still getting gains medically, and I know at over there at ISU, they're trying to do They're trying to do all kinds of stuff off, you know, things that Carver began.
Wow.
So he's really contributed greatly to not just African-American history, but to the American story in general.
And yet so many people have very little familiarity with him.
Oh, yeah. I knew the name. I knew he was famous, but I didn't know why. Yeah.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Xavier Cavazos, and the author of Diamond Grove Slave Tree. This title, of course, has huge significance in Carver's life, and so perhaps you could tell us a little bit about that and maybe read one of the poems about that.
Sure, I'd love to. So Carver was born in Diamond Grove, Missouri, so that's where the title kind of comes from. And then, you know, the slave tree part is that, you know, he was born a slave and that he was a tree to, a tree metaphorically, that he was something that was giving life to, you know, generations to come still. But one of, you know, there's a title poem from the book. It's called Diamond Grove Slave Tree as well. The little poem is, let me try to find it real quick. And so this was actually, you know, an event that Carver writes about in one of his biographies. That as a young child in Diamond, Missouri, he witnessed a lynching. And so I just kind of wrote this in his voice. It's called Diamond Grove Slave Tree. I see three trees wanting to swing me. Wild trees that look like me. Trees 3 feet wide and full of capital H, capital I, capital S, capital T, capital O, capital R, capital Y. Trees I should hide from, this dangling dark branch of a tree. No, yes, never, fully in air.
Xavier, why don't you share a few more poems from the book, too?
What's that?
Would you like to share a few more poems from the book?
Sure. Let me do that. Let me read one of the central pieces of the book, I believe, is biography of George Washington Carver for beginners. And so this is kind of like when someone says, well, tell me about Carver, but don't get too, you know, because if you ask me to tell you about Carver, I could take up an hour. My wife would say, well, give me the quick, short, important version of it, you know. So this was called Biography of George Washington Carver. And it's in two parts. I'll go ahead and read the two, I guess.
Yeah.
The first one's part one, Diamond Grove, Missouri, 1864. Arrive a genius of science. No. At Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute for training young men and women. Not yet. At Iowa State College with Joseph Budd and Lewis Pamel. Probably. At Simpson College in Iowa. Yes. At Highland Park University in Kansas. No, never. With art. Yes. Begin to learn to read and write with adopted parents named Carver and a birth brother named Jim. Hallelujah. On a plantation farm in Diamond, Missouri, a grove of walnut trees shaped like a precious stone. Absolutely. Arrive in Kansas, carried in the bag of a slave raider. Oh, sweet Mary. Stolen with a raped and murdered mother. Merciful God. With a dead father, a slave at birth, the dirt of Missouri mud. Sweet Jesus, Holy Father, let all of this, now and forever, finally, yes, amen. 2. Slave. A seed in soil, dry and brittle, lack of water, incorporated in collapsed darkness, with sewer and sea on lip. shackled to a foreign language, the new O's wider than the rim of mouth, the round I-O-U nothing of English bending heart beyond recognition. Best full sprint, not enough, as you are racked, as you are whipped, as you are whispered your new American name. Oh, lovely human, yes, begin. So there's two kind of the, that were kind of the central question of the book as I started writing it, which was, to sort of be a historical biography of Carver, and at the same time trying to never forget that he was born a slave, and how difficult, that all of his steps must have been. I can't imagine, one degree removed from being a slave, he's free, and now, he's moving around in America, in a country that still, participates in slavery, depending on what state you're in at the time, that how he had to negotiate all of those steps. And so, one of the things the readers can't, or the audience can't see, is kind of how the poem looks on the page. And, one of the things often, one of my intro to creative writing students would say, they'd be like, well, we don't know how to read the book. How to read it. Tell us how to read it. And I'm like, well, just read it how it is. There's a lot of space. I play with the delivery of space. So visually, the aesthetic that I was going for was to do two things, and that was to show a separation. Often there's a lot of poems that are kind of in columns or in that are the words are just completely separated, and so I wanted to think about how do we negotiate that environment which is completely separated, that every step I take forward, there's a negative space response going backwards, that distance between us. And that's what Carver's whole life was like, essentially. I mean, definitely, once he became famous, I'm sure entitlement became, there was more entitlement. But, and that's even not always true. I mean, there's some of his really kind of funny, sad stories about him later in life, where he would show up for these really prestigious speaking engagements from other universities. And then when he would get to the town or the association or the place having the event, they would inform him that he wasn't allowed to stay at the hotel that they had booked him. They'd book him a room at the hotel, and then once he'd arrived there, he was told he couldn't stay there. So there was always this air of separation, and he was usually quickest out of anyone to say, no, that's okay, I can go where I'm supposed to be, so that there would be no trouble. But I really wanted to try to see what that was like, what language would look like separated, because as much as we are human beings in this world, our language is tied to our ever being as who we are as humans, that I don't know if, language and the human can be separated, so that wherever he went, if he was separated from society or from other groups, that his language then, his thoughts, all this other stuff was always constantly being separated. And so I wanted to kind of see what that would be like to negotiate. And then the other thing, which was the funnest for me, but I think the most difficult for readers of the book, is that this aesthetic of totally taking out parts that are needed, right? So the book is completely fragmented. Sometimes a sentence will be torn apart in the middle, and there'll be a subject, there won't be a verb. Maybe there'll be a verb, but there'll be no subject. There'll be no noun. I just really messed with what was there, and that was to also imitate what he had to work with his whole life. So kind of what I said earlier in the show was that, Carver was someone who necessity is the key to ingenuity, and that he never had what he needed. You know, mm-hmm. If we were going to do a science experiment now, we'd go into a lab, we'd have all of our beakers, we'd have all of our fluids, we'd have our fire, we'd have our, you know, whatever was going to go into it, we'd have it all. And everything was set, would be controlled, a controlled lab, so to speak. And Carver never got that, you know. He never, his nothing was ever controlled, because he never controlled any of it. And he never had what was needed to make his experiments, so he always had to improvise. So I said to myself, well, if you're going to write about Carver, then you have to tie your hands the same way. Mm. But you're not going to be given your full vocabulary. You're not going to be given complete sentences. You're not going to be given every word in the dictionary. So what I kind of did is that, you know, in a way I kind of cheated. I did create a lot of the poems in with full language, and then in revision I would start selecting what needed to come out. And so the idea is, here's a book of poetry. It's not, I don't have the words needed to make it, but I needed to make it no matter what. Mm. So it's my best effort to imitate kind of an experiment that Carver had to live his whole life, you know, which was this aesthetic of never having what was needed, but still needing to produce. And now, you know, now the book's its own living voice, it's its own living artifact, it's its own representation, historical biography of Carver, that I would say, you know, maybe pushes me in areas that I wouldn't have, you know, grown, or I wouldn't have been able to develop or write a poem about if I would have had the full language. So, mm-hmm. you know, in a way, there's some surprising things to me in it, but also there's some successes, but there's also failures. You know, what I would believe are kind of failures, but we left them in the book as well, because I think that's part of also the Carver experience, is, you know, that he succeeded through failures. And I kind of wanted some of those to be on the page. It's hard to say it's also at this point now hard for me to decide between what's a success and a failure. And it's just kind of the way it is, you know. And I really wanted to go into this project keeping my integrity about that part of it, and not cheating, and not allowing myself to have.
Well, Javier, do you think that a reader would get more from the poetry if they have a little bit of background on Carver coming to it?
I think so.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I think it's a nice mixture, like, definitely, right? Because what's going to happen is, like, some emails I've received, they're like, oh, I love that. You know, for example, there's a poem in the book. It's three poems. They all have the same title. It's called When Carver Sat Down in the Highland Park Methodist Episcopal Eating House. And this is a poem that, if you knew some background about Carver, if you're a Carver scholar, you would recognize this event. And what it was that he couldn't, you know, at that point, you still weren't allowed to integrate black and white students eating. Mm. But all of Carver's students adored him, and they wanted him to eat with him, you know, his fellow students, his cohort. And so the story is he sat down, and when he sat down at this table, one of the white kids there that was upset about it started rattling his tray, like shaking his tray for Carver to move. So Carver did. He got up, he picked up his tray, and he went and he sat down at the other table. Well, then what happened was really a beautiful thing, and that's that the rest of the students who were at that table didn't agree with what that kid did, so they all kind of rattled their tray at him, and then they all got up and left him and went and sat with George. That's a really neat story, you know, and like I had one person say, hey, I recognize that you're writing that. And so, you know, two of them are from the research, you know, it's kind of try to create a narrative. And then the last one is, I'm trying to find it.
Yeah, we only have about 3 minutes, so maybe you can read this as a kind of our last.
Well, I like that one. Just thought you'd like to know, Mr. Carver. I like that one too.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see how much we can read in this next 3 minutes.
Let me do that. I thought you'd like to know. Because
okay.
I thought it was really important, just really quickly for the listeners. I thought it was really important for Carver to know. See, one of the things there's a picture of a document, and that's a letter I found between Joseph Budd. It was either Pamela or Budd, and it was a letter where he asked Carver, where did you get, because over at Iowa State University, they create this like, it was a big love fest between these two, right? And it really was. But I just thought it was kind of fascinating that one of them would write Carver and say, hey, where did you get your degree and when? Because you don't know of it, kind of. You know what I mean? Kind of like, hey, we've been seeing that your name has been coming with doctor lately. When and where did you get your degree? And so Carver had to write back this really kind of silly letter where he explained it as the janitor in the hall would always call him the good doctor, and it just kind of stuck, you know. And so he never received a degree of doctor, but that in 1999, Iowa State University bestowed upon him the honorary degree of doctor. So I thought that he should know that. And then also the one I thought he should know is that the United States gave him a stamp.
Yes.
He actually had two stamps. And so let me read that one real quick.
Okay.
I think there, let me try to find them. They're running out of time here.
On page 68.
Okay. So this is called Just Thought You'd Like to Know. I'm still trying to find it. That's why I'm going.
Page 68.
I'll find it.
Just
Let's see. I'm so sorry.
It's on page 68.
68, thank you.
Yes.
I never had that happen to me. Just thought you'd like to know, Mr. Carver, that there is a 32-cent stamp of you out there, somewhere, right now, with a sweet potato and peanut plant right behind a microscope, with your name typed beautifully along the right side of the edge, and you are grinning, George. Grinning like you just won a great big hand of poker. Grinning like a wild big bet. And the United States of America, good old Glory herself, has put all of her authority, all of her amazing grace, everything all gloriously around you.
And we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us. Javier Cavazos, author of Diamond Grove Slave Tree. And, Mom, you've got a final word for us?
Oh, yeah, I do. And I can find it. Yeah. Minds are like parachutes. They only function when open.
Thank you so much for being with us, Javier.
I love that.
See you next week on Writer's Voices.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate that.
Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.